So what are the elements of the system that you personally feel are counter innovation, counterproductive elements of the patent system?
The government's involved.
Hey there, you're listening to episode 20 of The Flyover Effect, our podcast about startups, design, and all things internet. I'm Scott Rocketship, your producer and frequent co-host, also appearing on this episode from BitMethod, Dan Shipton. You can learn more about our company at www.bitmethod.com. Joining us on this program, Iowa patent attorney Brett Trout. He's also the author of Cyberlaw, a legal arsenal for online business. Dan and I ask him dumb questions about patent and trademark law and get very smart answers. And a reminder, this is legal information, not legal advice. I am definitely, definitely not a lawyer. I'm pretty sure Dan is not a lawyer, and Brett is a lawyer, but he's not your lawyer. Enjoy the show. I feel like in people's imaginations, maybe, okay, first consultation, and then after that, I'm going to get $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 bills coming through. What might it look like for somebody that just wants to have their intellectual property decently protected for a new web startup?
Well, you know, I've seen that happen, too, that you have to keep the reins on the attorney. You go to a larger firm, and you know, they're just designed to bill. And unless you put some reins on them, you could certainly end up with a $20,000, $30,000 bill. If you're looking for trademarks, you're generally looking about $1,200 to $1,300 for a federal trademark registration. A lot of times, if you go online, it'll say, well, you know, it's $300 for the trademark application. But that's just $300 to fill out the form. You got to pay another $325 for the fee. And then if you get it kicked back, then there's going to be back and forth that you're going to have to pay hourly. So that $1,200 to $1,300 is what I would figure to be the overall cost.
And actually going through an attorney and doing it right the first time, I'm guessing.
right.
Probably saves a lot of money.
I get a lot of clients that come to me and they say, yeah, I did this and I screwed it all up. And can you fix it for me? I get the feeling like a surgeon probably would when the guy comes in and goes, yeah, I took my gallbladder out. I did the hard part. Can you just sew it back up? And, you know, you're going to die of gangrene. It's going to be very expensive. But it's difficult to make a client understand that once you've messed it up, there's not a lot we can do to fix it up. So, and if we do fix it, it's going to be much more expensive than if we did it right the first time.
And it's, from my understanding, it's not just paperwork. Like it's more involved than that. There's classes and like different areas that you're protecting. And
exactly. You know, the key is that you can, I've seen people get trademarks, but they don't know how bad the registration is until they actually come to the point where they have to sue somebody or they get sued by somebody. And the critical determinations as to what you were talking about, which classification they go into, what's the description of the goods, what's the date of first use. A mistake on any one of those could be the difference between losing a $80,000 federal trademark litigation suit and winning an $80,000 trademark litigation suit. So it's pretty critical. And like I said, once you mess it up, it's very difficult to go back and fix that.
I'm guessing, Brett, when you look at a company, maybe even just talk to the people involved, that it becomes apparent pretty quickly to someone like you whether or not they've actually talked to an attorney.
right. And it's helpful because there's a distinction between legal information and legal advice. You can get a lot of legal information online, find out the general principles behind trademarks, when they're good, when they're bad, patents, good or bad, but actually applying them to your business and your business goals is going to be where the advice comes in. And I think that's where a lot of attorneys get tripped up. They just think, should I do it or should I not do it? And if they can do it, they will do it. I get clients ask me all the time, should I file a patent? And I think the response they get from a lot of patent attorneys is, sure, you know, you should certainly do that because there's no downside to the attorney for you doing it. There is a slight downside if the attorney tells you not to do it and you don't do it and then you end up losing money down the line. But I think a good attorney is going to say, hey, you know, you're looking at an estimate from a business standpoint of $20,000 return on this. I don't think you need to spend $10,000 on a patent application. So giving your attorney a bunch of information and coming in heads up with some legal information already in your head is going to be advantageous. You're going to be able to get the most out of your attorney.
What kind of information do you recommend people look at in advance? I mean, if you take compare it to another specialist, like a doctor, I feel like generally they are looking at me sideways anytime I bring up or suggest anything that I've read online at all it's, you know, they seem very touchy about, like, right. Oh boy, somebody's been on the internet, somebody's been on WebMD, you know, let's just let the professionals do their work now. It sounds like you're saying it's a little different.
Well, I think it's a little different. I mean, you're certainly going to run into attorneys where you go in there and say, hey, I thought this or I thought that. And my impression is when professionals get defensive about you doing your own kind of research, it's typically because they're concerned that you're going to know something that they don't know. It's very plausible that you would have picked up something, the latest, greatest, newest study that they haven't seen yet, and they don't want to appear that they don't understand it, you know, because you've spent 6 hours studying it and they've never even seen it. But with me, if they've come in with something and it's something I haven't seen before, I'll just say, I'll check it out and get back to you. But in terms of what you should look at, I was running into that over and over again, and I was thinking, there's a lot of information I'm giving you that I'm charging you a very large amount of money to receive that you could just get handily. So I put that all together and I put it in a book. And that's been pretty advantageous. Clients really like that because it's, again, back to that legal information. It's just information that applies across the board to most companies, and then they can kind of pick and choose and ask questions about how that might apply to their business.
So that seems like common sense, but I think maybe it's something that people don't think about a lot of. If you're going to pay someone with special skills that's very good at what they do, you want to use them for the very difficult, very specialized work and not be paying them to, you know, take you to patent and trademark law 101 or, you know, internet best practices 101 for protecting your stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, you might want to look at, if your attorney has a blog, you can go look at that attorney's blog. And like, if you were coming to me, I probably have 80 articles on trademark law, and you can just go through those and get an impression. So you're looking at my ideas and my philosophy and my strategy with regard to protecting your trademark as it applies to your business, and then you'll be hot basically when you come in, so we can ask the right questions, get the right things done.
If we were to go sideways and talk about software patents for a minute, to me, like, trademarks and patents have always been very interesting, but for me, I'm never quite certain how patents apply to software, because everything we're building on top of generations and generations of things that have already been figured out. And from my standpoint, it looks to me like people acquire patents for the same reason they acquire nuclear weapons, to say that they have them, not necessarily to use them.
Yeah, that there's a lot of different reasons people acquire patents. One thing is that it increases the size of the portfolio, makes them a better buyout prospect. Another thing is defensively, you know, Google and Apple, they just have so many patents, and that guaranteed mutual destruction thing is kind of a lot of those companies have it. But in the last 10 years, there's been this patent troll epidemic where companies, they don't actually make anything, they don't invent anything. All they do is go around and find patents that are out there and buy the patents, and then they go after people who might be using them. Now, because they don't make anything, they don't have any, there's not going to be any counterclaims against them for patent infringement. So if I sue you for patent infringement, you're not going to sue me back, because all I do is sue people for a living. So that's been a big problem. That's gotten a lot of people upset. Another reason is because they use this kind of an automatic, I call it kind of robo-litigation, where they've done all the paperwork and they've tried this case 10 times and they're coming after you. It's going to cost you far more than it would cost them to try this case. And, you know, kind of their worst case scenario is that they just lose and you don't get any attorney fees from them. And so they tend to be a little more aggressive on what might constitute infringement or not. Because I go to clients and they get approached and I said, well, you know, we could fight it, but it's going to cost $200,000 to fight it, or you can pay this $10,000 license fee. I mean, I'd much rather have you pay me $200,000 then pay them $10,000, but in good conscience, I mean, you just have to go with what is most pragmatic. If you have enough of those people get together, you can do a class action, you know, or get together and find some other patents that have been out there before and try to destroy that patent. But, you know, it's a big problem, and that's kind of what the patent reform is kind of designed to address to a certain extent.
Do you think there's a size, like, as far as maybe the entry point into getting into, like, full-scale patents and like going in and starting to collect them as a business? Do you think there's like a size that you reach where then it becomes kind of important?
Well, I think as opposed to size, there could be very big companies that wouldn't need any patents, I've had very, very small clients that the patents have turned out to be extremely valuable. In terms of what size you should be to get a patent, I think you should look at it from the point of how litigious you are, how much do you want to go into court, how aggressive you are, how much money you have. If you're kind of an aggressive business person and you want to keep other people out of your space and you have a little extra money that you could throw that way, you can carve out a very big monopoly in an area because your competitors are going to be less likely to come after you. We had a client that he invented a product and everyone was infringing because they just knew who he was and they didn't think that he had the strength and the size to go after him. And he just went after one person and just tore it to shreds, and then boom, just a whole string of licenses after that. So I've worked with extremely small companies and gotten very, very good results, but you have to want to, it's kind of a Mexican or a kind of a game of chicken there that, if you blink first, you could lose a whole bunch. And the thing I was thinking about before was a Mexican standoff where both people have guns pointed at each other and you just got to see who's going to fire first or drop their gun. And if you are smart and you have the resources and you're not going to flinch in litigation, you can end up making a lot of money just because the big boys try to roll over you and they're playing a game too, because if they don't roll over you, then they end up writing a big fat check.
So I'm probably not as well read on this stuff as I should be, but philosophically speaking, where does the logic come from that people can even buy patents? Like this idea that, well, you didn't make this, but some aggressive business owner who wants to carve out that monopoly, who's not having ideas, who's not necessarily innovating, can just use lawyers and checkbooks to carve out an ownership of a scope of ideas. Yeah.
Well, the philosophy came because all of these rules were put together before the internet existed. And the thinking was, if I invent something, but I don't have the resources to manufacture it, then I go to a big company. That's always the holy grail, is some inventor invents something and then takes his patent to some big company and then they pay him a ton of money or pay him an ongoing royalty stream for that. So that was always the philosophy. It wasn't, the laws weren't put into place with the understanding that at some point in the future, we'll have this screen in front of us that'll be able to identify thousands of infringers just by clicking a couple buttons. In the past when that happened, to find an infringer, especially like this case that I just talked about, you'd have to go out and look at every farm field and see who's using what. But with this, the IT end of it, you can go online and just put in some search terms and find out who's potentially an infringer. So that's the big problem is that the laws were designed for more articles of manufacture as opposed to business methods.
Well, and not only is it easy to find those infringers, but the means of manufacturing or producing that idea are for most ideas in the hands of just about anyone now, right?
Right.
There's no reason that the guy with the idea needs maybe one other person with some skill set they're missing to make that idea some sort of functional reality, to actually produce something.
Right. And in the past, litigation wasn't so scalable. Now it's very scalable. You can go spend a lot of money on one particular case and then understand that all these cases are going to be somewhat similar. So having the ability to, and that's a big threat too, that if I go after you and say, I already have $200,000 worth of paperwork done and I just basically fill in your name on this, that's going to be pretty intimidating for you to resist.
So I get when we're talking about physical things being manufactured, how obvious to maybe patent examiners who are looking at this stuff, looking at would somebody just be able to think this up? When it gets into like the software side, and one click checkout, and we've got a patent about that. Like that seems obvious to everybody on the face of the earth. Like if we were to start working towards changing the system to actually really reward those things that are truly innovations, like the Google Map Reduce. Like that was a problem that had been out there for a long, long time, and all of a sudden somebody came up with a really novel solution, and they should be able to protect that. But you know, one click checkout. I don't know.
Well, and the problem was is that there, in the 90s, there weren't any business method patents. They didn't let any kind of those kind of one click patents out there. And when they all of a sudden they decided they were going to let them go, there was just a deluge. And if you file a patent on a mousetrap, then the examiner goes to the big file of mousetrap patents and looks through them all and says, here's why it looks like these 15 others. If there's never been any business method patents before and you file one, you know, in 1999, they go to the file and there's no other prior art there. There's no other previous patents that they can use. So they allowed a lot of patents that shouldn't be allowed because they just didn't have the resources. The internet wasn't where it is today, and they just couldn't stop that from happening. So there are bad patents out there, but a lot of those were done very early on, and they have either been significantly curtailed in their scope, or they've been canceled, or they've just not been enforced. So I don't think you're seeing too many. When I hear a lot of IT people very upset, and they're like, oh, they're patenting everything, and they shouldn't patent software because it's really stifling innovation. When I ask them for a specific patent that they think should not have been granted, that's really where they kind of falter. The one-click patent was bad, but that was an Amazon deal, and they unfortunately delayed some gentleman's books that he had ordered to New Zealand, and he got upset that his books were delayed. And so he, of his own volition, filed a reexamination and knocked out most of those. The broadest claims of that patent are all gone because of that one individual. So that would not be something that your average bear would be able to do. But because the cache of business method patents had grown to such an extent and they were so easy for anyone to search, he could do it pretty inexpensively and show basically how that was obvious at that particular point in time.
So do you think that there's more to be done as far as making sure good patents get in? Do you think that that problem's already been solved and we're just dealing with baggage at this point? If we were to start to reform it to level the playing field, to make it so it wasn't so much about just that mutually assured destruction?
Well, I mean, those are kind of two different questions. The mutually assured destruction thing, I don't know how we're going to get around that because, you know, if the patents are 100% valid, I mean, if you could just say, have some supreme being look at them and say, these are good, these are bad, and get rid of all the bad ones, you would still have both companies having a whole bunch of them because I know you're infringing and I'm infringing you, but we're going to agree that we're going to agree to talk these things out, and I'm going to tell you, make it look less like the iPhone, or I'm going to sue you, and you say, well, I'm going to do this, and neither one of us can afford to go to court. So I don't think we're ever going to get rid of that mutually assured destruction thing. But in terms of making the patents better, I don't have the solution. The solution that the patent office has come up with is crowdsourcing that before they actually issue a patent. That might work, it might not. We'll just have to see.
Seems like a logical path. I mean, if it's so easy to find people infringing on your patents, you would think before these patents are granted, it would be just as easy for the person granting them to maybe do their own Google search and see, you know, and see if that stuff exists. And I'm sure the tests they use for validity are a little more complex than, oh, somebody already has it. But I mean, at the same time, you see things get granted that don't, you know, it's difficult, I think, for an outsider or for an average bear like me to look at some of the patents that get awarded and understand the logic behind it of, oh, yeah, this person obviously invented this. You know, in my layman's understanding, like having a patent on something involves inventing, involves having an idea first, involves being a person who has innovated, truly innovated something of, I'm going to do this differently than anyone else is doing it, and I don't currently have the means to take this to market at full steam. If I did, I would just do it, and maybe I wouldn't even need the patent, but since I don't, I'm going to try and protect it a little bit. And so there's, I don't know, from the outsider's perspective, there just seems to be a little bit of a logical breakdown in the stuff that does go through.
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly tends to be a catch-22. You don't want to, because you kind of got to jump in with both feet, and you're either all in or you're all out. You know, people always want to say, hey, is there some simple way where I can put this on hold and preserve it, and then if I find out it works and start making some money, then I can go ahead and protect it. That's going to be completely gone. There's not going to be any avenue for that, so you got to kind of jump in with both feet. But it'll make my life a lot easier at cocktail parties when, you know, some tech guy comes up and says, well, they're issuing all these bad patents. I'll say, hey, you know, for the past couple of years, they've had this program where if you think one patent doesn't deserve to go, you can just send it in and stop that patent from happening. So I think a lot of the problem arises from people read a patent and they don't. There's two parts of the patent. One is a description of what the product is, very detailed, and then what is what the claim is. And they'll read it and they'll say, man, this guy got a patent on a chair, you know, and really what he got a patent on was a little, you know, square lumbar massager part of it that's in the corner. And if you don't have that little square massager part of it, then it doesn't infringe. So reading patents, and I understand, I mean, I just had some very technologically savvy clients talked to me about a patent and they just said, why don't you guys write like normal people? I mean, these are tech guys sure. that are telling me that it's just unintelligible. And so it is very difficult to for anyone to read, especially a technological patent, to determine what the scope of the protection is. But if people looked at that, I think they'd be a lot less upset at the scope of patents being granted.
Sounds like an awesome program. Like it sounds, you know, obviousornot.com, you know, style, where you're learning about patents and how to read them, and at the same time, like knocking out the bad stuff. That I'd go there once a week.
They made it fun.
Yeah,
especially.
Upvote, downvote it. You just bury it in Reddit.
Yeah.
So go really radical with me. Assume the system didn't exist at all. And I'm just trying to imagine, like, there's patents don't exist. There just is no patent. And let's also pretend, I don't know, the Slinky doesn't exist. And I've invented it. I have this spring-based toy, and I can't apply for a patent on it, but I want to talk to manufacturers and possibly get this thing produced and not, you know, spill the beans and lose all potential at that first meeting. Couldn't I use some form of NDA, non-compete, non-disclosure, other means of protecting an idea and intellectual property that I have and dealing with third parties without relying on this, I own this idea, I own it forever, I can sell it to people, it goes up on auction, companies that don't make anything can buy it up, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, if there weren't any patents, then no one would want to sign an NDA, because if I take it to this toy manufacturer A and say, sign this NDA, they're going to say, well, I don't want to sign that because if we have it being currently built in-house, you know, we don't want to have that kind of a problem where you think it was invented by you. But more importantly, we don't want to sign that NDA because toy company B didn't sign that. So if we get into these talks and then we agree to pay you a license fee of 5%, as soon as it hits the market, those guys are going to reverse engineer it and they'll make it and they'll be at a 5% advantage over us because they don't have to pay you any money. So the patent really ensures that you have this monopoly and your licensee is not going to get swamped by, you know, lose a competitive advantage by their competitors.
That's a good explanation. I've never heard anybody explain it to me that way before. I appreciate it. That's right. Good. A lot of the conversation that you read about these kinds of things do seem very incensed, very outraged. A lot of tech people are just, I can't believe this, I can't believe that. So some of it to me seems a perception of fairness or justice kind of missing from the system. Maybe not an actual sense of justice or fairness, but a perception thereof. And, you know, take the patent trolls, for example. That seems an area that a lot of people riled up about, and understandably so. It reminds me of a book I read in grade school. I think it was called How to Be a Perfect Person in Just 8 Days. And this kid does like a mail order program, you know, and it like steps him through all these different ways of being a perfect person. And the final step in the process is don't do anything. Like, stay in your bed all day and don't do anything. And that kind of seems the patent troll MO right there. If they're not producing anything, if they're not doing anything, nobody's going to be able to sue them back, because how could they possibly infringing? Because they're not producing a product. They just have this arsenal. You know, it's a difficult enemy to attack at that point.
Right. I mean, and that's one way to go with it. But you know, most of the inventors that I run across, the individual little guy inventors, I mean, they don't have the manufacturing set up to do that. And so if they approached the company and said, you know, would you license this from me? The company would just manufacture it and say, you know, you're not manufacturing it. And so we're not going to pay you anything because you can't sue us. So it's a balance between protecting the little guy and protecting the patent trolls. Now, you know, if you wanted to say something where only the inventor has the right to do that, you know, that might be a one thing to help it along a little bit, but it's going to be difficult. And you could say, you could make something arbitrary to say, you know, you cannot enforce more than 5 patents a year that you don't own, those kind of things. But it's difficult because if you just said you can't sue anybody unless you're actually making it, that's really going to hurt the little guy who doesn't have the resources to make it.
Hmm. Remind me again how long a patent is.
Patent, it used to be 20 years from the date that it, it used to be 17 years from the date that it issued, and now it's 20 years from the date that you file. They kind of assume that it's going to be 3 years in the works, and so it's going to be the same length of time. The reason they changed that over was because they'd have what are called submarine patents, and somebody would come up with something in 1980 about doing something online, and you can get a patent on something as long as it's capable of, as long as it works, you can do it. Now, the fact that it's, you know, way too heavy and way too expensive and no one would ever build one, that doesn't matter, because what they would do is they'd get the patent and then they'd wait 20, 30 years before that technology would be there to make it work. And then they'd all of a sudden say, they'd play around with the patent office for 10 years. And then once somebody else started making it, then they'd have it issue right away. And then they get 17 years from that date. So they didn't want anybody playing games like that. I think all of those patents are gone. I mean, technically someone could have filed a patent back in, you know, 1985, and had that just walling around for a while and still pop up. Because anything filed in the earlier date still has that submarine potential. But I think all those are gone now, so we're not going to run into that problem.
The length strikes me a little bit as absurd for software patents now, because 20 years ago, like, we barely had cell phones. And we barely, like, our computer was the size, still like the size of a small couch or something. And I don't, you know, then I think, oh, well, what would be a good length for something new? And it would all be shorter than it would take for the patent office to actually get something out.
Right. And, you know, other countries have decided that they're going to give software patents a shorter period of time. But I mean, you hit it on the head that, you know, you want software patents to be protected for the first 3 years and then that's it. But they're going to take 4 years to even get through the process. I mean, if you file a mousetrap, you might be able to get it through in 2 or 3 years, but, you know, a software type patent, you're not going to get that out in 4 years. And so someone can get in there, get some money off it, and then get out before your patent even actually issues. So it's a tough decision. I mean, the key would be to turn these around, you know, within 12 months. They do have a program where basically if you do all the government's work yourself and then pay the government a larger fee, you can go in there and say, here's our patent, we already did the search, and here's our results, and here's why the patent's valid. And then they have an examiner look it over, do a cursory search to make sure that you hit all the right prior art, and then you actually get it issued. But, you know, that certainly favors the big guy over the little guy.
So what are the elements of the system that you personally feel are counter innovation, counterproductive elements of the patent system?
Oh, the government's involved. the problem is that there's really no motivation on the part of the patent office to turn these around quickly. The thing is that the fees going in, they're actually making money, and Congress is taking that money, the extra money that should go, that inventors have paid for the filing fees, and diverting it to other sort resources. That's going to stop. Hopefully that they would be able to take that money, put it back into getting some examiners. So if you had more examiners that are more well trained, you're going to get a better result, and it's going to be a quicker result. There are very intelligent, very highly skilled examiners at the patent office, but they're not the majority, and they tend to end up being managers. So they're managing 6 people who can't do it very well. So that's the problem. If all the supervisors were actually doing the work, you'd get things turned around high quality very quickly.
Do you know what the pace of patents being put out is now compared to, like, 50 years ago? Because it seems like, you know, like, civilization is kind of like, we are just a slow snowball effect. And right now it seems like we're in an age where things are really picking up. We're really moving. I guess, you know, there's a period in the 60s where we got on the moon. But like, we're on a roll right now. And I don't know if getting all this government involved in 20 years. Like, at some point, like, the patents are going to have so much teeth that, like, innovation is not a cool thing to do anymore, or...
Well, I mean, the problem is that when the problem was is that they never allowed these kind of patents, and then they allow them, and so there's going to be these huge patents that carve out a huge area. But as patents get more narrow, I mean, no one's going to come up with an internet patent. I mean, they're going to be necessarily more particularized to what they're going to be granular, and so you're not going to have that problem. So avoiding somebody else is going to be just a step to the left, as opposed to, you know, taking a train to the next state. So I think as things go on, that's going to be, you're going to see more of that patents are going to be very, very specialized to one particular thing, and they're going to be easier to avoid. So you're innovating in this one little area, and you carve out that area to yourself, and you're not going to be stepping on anybody else's toes. And to your point of how patents have progressed, I mean, I just looked up one last night that was a 4 million patent, and that was 1980. So, in the last 200 years, we did 4 million patents, and then they just issued patent number 7 million now. So, just since 1980.
So it's really picked up.
Yeah, it's pretty logarithmic, I think. I haven't put a calculator to it.
We'll put Neil on it.
Yeah.
He'll get us a chart.
It's also just like our government.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. I bet if you did it with the debt or the expanse of government, it would be a very similar curve.
Have you come across any really interesting approaches to patents? I mean, are there companies out there that are buying them up and open sourcing them, or you know, nonprofit, copyleft, you know, et cetera, kind of approaches to that level of intellectual property?
It's an interesting question, but patents are so expensive to get that for someone to get it, they're so motivated that they're just not going to let it go for anything. They're going to have somebody pay them much more than they put into it to get it out. And a lot of times, I would say the majority of inventors don't make enough from their invention to pay for the cost of the patenting process. You'll see, if you go on eBay, you can buy a lot of patents. People are, you know, really? I had this, you can go there. I have a patent myself, and I just got it just because I thought it'd be cool. And there was an old patent attorney that I worked for, and he did that. And I thought, well,
this seems dangerous. I hope my dad doesn't listen to this podcast, because I feel like he's going to pick up a new hobby.
Are you going to tell us about what you invented?
Oh, it was just a medicine bottle, because I heard they were coming out with some new regulations that required medicine tops to be inaccessible by anyone under 5 years old, and they had to be easy to open by old people. And so I thought, what could you do there? And so what it was I figured dexterity wasn't going to be what the advantage was going to be. It's going to be thinking. And so I had this special key that you could put on a ring, and if you just held it, even if you can't even move your hands, you could open it. But I myself, without the key, I couldn't open it myself, so it would keep all the kids away. But if you were old enough to understand the complexities of how this key worked,
sure,
you were probably okay to take the medicine. But they didn't make the regulation, so I didn't pursue it. I mean, I got the patent, but I didn't try to market it.
Well, you just hold on to it for a few years and put it back on eBay, right?
That's right. Well, the thing is that people put all this money into it, and they're like, you know, it didn't work just because this one little thing didn't happen. No, it didn't work because nobody wanted it. people come into me all the time, and they say, well, what if, you know, during that first 3 years while it's pending, what if someone steals it? And I said, man, that would be the best thing that could happen to you. I mean, because 95% of the time,
nothing happens.
So,
crickets.
Yeah, if someone steals it, then, yeah, you've lost $1 million in the first 3 years, but then you have $14 million over the next 17 years. So it's a pretty good trade-off. I would think that'd be a good thing, because the key is, and I think you guys know this probably better than anybody, I mean, it's not the idea, it's not the invention, it's the marketing and the connections and the distribution. So when people come in and they say, is it a good idea or not a good idea? Over the last 20 years, one guy just about told him to leave because it was just, I didn't want to take his money because it was, the idea was kind of goofy, ended up turning seven figures on it. So, but that wasn't because I don't think the idea was necessarily that good. This guy was a business major. He had a lot of connections. He'd done it before. He'd worked in companies and saw how it was done. And so he made this happen. He could have made anything happen. Other people come in, and if they had that invention right in front of them, I would buy one from them right now for the price that I know they could make it for. Never went anywhere. And it's the invention's great. They just didn't know the right people. They couldn't get their foot in the door. So in terms of whether you should get an invention or not, people say, you know, think it's 90% the invention and 10% everything else. You really need to think, do I have the connections to make this thing go? And if you do, then it's a good idea to get it patented.
Is there anything you can do to protect yourself from patent trolls? Because it sounds, you know, like we're a small shop. We don't have any patents. They do. But at the same time, they don't do anything. So it doesn't even make...
You can move your business overseas, right? That's what a lot of people are doing now.
Yeah. But it's not even good for us to, like, go get one because we'd never be able to use it against them. And the, you know, the big companies that might care don't because we're still a small fish.
Right. Well, you know, and most of the patent trolls are looking for their lawsuit is pretty rickety, and so they don't want to go after any big dogs who'll actually fight them. And because if they lose, not only do they lose, they're probably going to lose their patent. So they want to go after little people and just go after a bunch of little people and extract $5,000 to $10,000 settlements for all these people. About the only way you can protect yourself is just kind of keep an eye out as to who's doing what with what patents, and then try to stay out of that space, you know, as much as you can. The other thing is that if you do get sued, look around because there's probably a lot of other people who just got sued on the same thing. And if you can collectively get together and try to destroy this patent, that will stop it. And I think if you had a business that was in charge of doing nothing but attacking patent troll patents, I mean, I think a lot of companies would, and you know, would be happy to donate to that, and you could just have this giant conglomerate just as a giant laser beam just tearing up
a rebel alliance.
That's exactly
that
right.
Sounds like a whole new insurance agency that just got created right there.
All right, so I'm gonna get a patent on that and good to go.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you a lot. It was great.
Thank you, Brett.
Yeah, thanks for being on. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me.